What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, and I'm CNBC producer Cameron Costa. On today's episode, the House Speaker's job is safe, for now.
It's up to Mike Johnson to prove that he's a Republican. It's up to Mike Johnson to earn back people's trust and support.
Speaker Johnson joins us after surviving a bid within his own party to oust him.
This is a dangerous time in history, world history, and certainly here on our own shores, and we cannot afford to be playing petty politics here. This country needs a functioning Congress.
And a year on Ozempic. Author and journalist Johan Hari says it's changed his life.
47% of Americans want to take this drug. This is the biggest, obesity is the biggest killer in the society. These drugs are going to be enormous.
But the risks are just as heavy as the benefits.
The worst case scenario is we could have an opioid-like scale of death toll of young girls who are able to amputate their appetite using these drugs in a way they wouldn't be.
Plus, President Biden is giving Israel an ultimatum, and the bundle is back. Streamers are taking a page out of the cable playbook.
I need every single thing.
You do. You are a unique.
I need every single thing that's available, and there's still nothing.
I know.
It's Thursday, May 9th.
Hello, it's 2024. That's what's happening here.
Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1. Cue, please.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. The Dow closed up yesterday for the sixth session in a row. S&P was down just barely yesterday, so was the NASDAQ. The Dow coming off its sixth positive session, the longest winning streak of the year. It rose 172 points. It's now up about 1% for the week to date.
Meantime, President Biden saying the U.S. would not supply Israel with certain weapons and artillery shells. That is if its military invades Rafah, a city in southern Gaza where more than 1 million people are sheltering. He made the comments in an interview with CNN. The move would mark a big shift in U.S. policy towards the war, though the president said the U.S. would continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of what he described as the Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks. But the political attacks starting almost immediately based on that interview all over the country and the world. There's a lot of criticism on one side and praise on the other, and it's getting complicated very, very quickly.
Some in Israel, I think some of the Israeli more far-right elements who are pushing back and saying Hamas loves Biden after some of the things.
There's people saying Hamas loves Biden. There are people saying Michigan over Israel. There's a whole lot of critique of this
right
now.
You really think any of that is inaccurate? I mean, I don't want to weigh in on it because I look at it, I know exactly what's going on, and I think it's just horrific. I think it's horrific. When you, right at the very beginning, it was clear what Israel had to do, and it was going to be hard. And now it's come to the point where one of our greatest allies and the most stable ally we have in that region of the world, which is such an important region of the world, we're basically pulling the rug out from under. You do?
I do.
In this case?
I do. And I think it goes very much to actually what we showed that clip yesterday of General Mark Milley saying, which is that the great conundrum of war today is all about having to, you have to do it quickly. You have to get in and out because the politics of doing it.
Israel has every right to defend itself. War is a horrible thing. I had a lot of years in combat, been shot at, blown up, the whole nine yards, right? It's a horrible, brutal, vicious thing. And unfortunately, because the character of war is going to be in dense urban areas, that the very conduct of war is going to have very high levels of collateral damage. There's almost no way around it. But if there's any morality at all, you need to get into it, achieve your political objectives, get it done fast, and get it over with.
And he was making also a moral argument, too, because he said, You know, he said all of this is questionable. I mean, by the way, he showed videos and saying we've done things that are questionable. But I think that is the point in many ways, which is to say that if you feel like your entire existence is existentially at threat, you know, there are things that you may have to do, and they may not be pleasant things. The question, of course, is can you look? I have great empathy for the people, the innocent people in Gaza. I like everybody else does. The question
war is how.
How do you do this?
They send you the same pictures they send me on Twitter, and war is hell. No one wants to see that. No one wants that to happen. With that said, we know how this started, and we know how really it needs to finish. I mean, I certainly don't want to talk about being the only country to ever use a, you know, an atomic weapon. But at that point in the war, it was either U.S. lives or what happened. And, you know, I'm sure on college campuses, if you ask, 90% would say that should have never happened. But there's a whole contingent of people in this country that still think that was the right thing to do
And by the way, you have to put yourself back in that particular time when they were making decisions to send their husbands, their sons, their brothers.
It would have dragged out another, we would have lost another, theoretically, another 50 or 100,000 Americans.
Right.
I mean, it all came home to roost in Oppenheimer when you saw him, you know, Cillian Murphy celebrating what happened, and you could see how much he was struggling with what the effects were.
On this vote, the yeas are 359, the nays are 43, with 7 answering present. The motion is adopted. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
Wow, I get a podium and everything.
Ms. Green, were you surprised by the number of votes against your motion?
No, not at all. I fully expected the vote count today.
House Speaker Mike Johnson survived a challenge from Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who tried to oust him from power. The vote to kill Greene's motion to vacate the Speaker's chair was 359 to 43, and just 10 Republicans voted with Greene. But think about before the Democrats were helping, it wouldn't have taken 10. With Kevin McCarthy, how many did it take? Just a handful. They call them the Crazy Eight, Matt Gaetz and the Crazy Eight. After the vote, Speaker Johnson said he appreciated the show of confidence from his colleagues, and the Speaker will join us live from Washington.
I was thinking through some of this. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene brought this because he cooperated with the Democrats to pass something.
To pass the Israeli aid, which they're not getting anyway.
But for her vote, she had 43 votes. Only 10 of them were Republicans. 77% of the people who voted with her were Democrats.
Right. It's all strange bedfellows, but
she's cooperating with
cynically. I think, you know, if you go, there's how many members in the House, you know, 450, whatever it is, but there's a lot of them, and they can labor in obscurity for years, or they can do stuff like this and become household names. But self-aggrandizement versus why you're sent there. Yeah. But I guarantee you, she'd say, self-aggrandizement, this has nothing to do with me. This is what he allowed to happen with the Democrats. It's just outrage, blah, blah, blah. But it really is self-aggrandizement when it comes down to it, right?
Yeah, that is a big fly. You think about some of the ones that you know.
Well,
Matt Gaetz.
Right.
George Santos. You know, the names that pop out are the ones who.
Did you see the press conference with the squad?
Yeah, exactly.
Yesterday?
That's what I mean. That's how you get attention.
It's like, where am I? But it did show, wow, that is a wacky place, the House. I mean, you got factions that are so.
Those are the names you know.
Meantime, I want to talk to you about this Chinese EV maker, NIO. It said overnight that it will launch its lower price brand on May 15th. So mark your calendar for next week. The brand is called Onvo, which stands for On Voyage. The launch coming ahead of a similar new line from rival XPeng expected in the next 2 or 3 months. NIO saying the first Onvo model, the L60, will be family-centric, a vehicle priced around $34,000 in the same segment as Tesla's Model Y. And Elon Musk has been very outspoken about how he thinks that some of these Chinese electric vehicles, are better, with the exception of Tesla, he says, than all the American-made cars right now. And therefore, we need tariffs, was his
argument.
And
that's been the argument that's come from the big three, too. Right. If you talk to Ford or any of them, they are all kind of looking for the same thing, some protections from what might be coming.
Bundle is back. Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery are planning to offer their streaming services, Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max, in a bundle which mirrors the traditional cable TV package. It will be available this summer, both for ad-supported and ad-free tiers. Pricing hasn't been disclosed. Disney's going to be the distributor and will collect subscription fees and pay a percentage of those fees to Warner Brothers Discovery. Who would we be missing? You'd be missing a lot.
Yeah. A whole bunch of folks. Yeah. Sure.
So then you need another, you need a couple
you
of bundles.
Need more.
You might need three or four bundles.
Or five. To get back to where you were with cable box.
Yeah, but the point is you're not hopefully not going to pay as well, as then, much as cable
and
box.
Then it's not going to be as profitable for each of these entities either.
Hello. Hello. It's 2024. That's what's happening here.
Nobody's going to ever make money in this business.
Analog dollars or digital pennies, nickels, whatever you want to call them.
I still don't understand why it's so different just depending on the pipes and why the margins get squeezed so much more than traditional.
What do you mean you don't
understand? I just don't understand. If you're basically paying to get the same amount of content, it ought to cost the same. It shouldn't matter how you
because
get the content.
Because there are three forms of content now. If you've got YouTube, if you've got TikTok, if you've got X, if you have any of these other free forms of content, that's where people are spending a lot of time too.
So I'm not even taking that piece on. I'm taking on the other piece, which is just people are going to buy it a la carte. That's been the whole point. And once you break it up, and if you buy it a la carte, and you're not going to buy all the channels, there's less channels.
A la carte is going to mean you'd also have to buy Netflix for this.
If you wanted to own everything, but most Americans don't need to own and see.
That's why
all five or six or seven of these.
That's
things.
Why when Peacock had an NFL game, you had to sign up.
See that. And Prime, a lot of people are already paying for because they like the free shipments from.
But think about all the people who don't. Yeah. You know, there are people in America, unfortunately or fortunately, who don't care about either basketball or football or whatever it is, and so. They're not getting the service at all.
I need every single thing.
You do. You are unique.
I need every single thing that's available, and there's still nothing.
I know.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, Speaker Mike Johnson survives a vote to oust him from his office. The Speaker of the House is with us to respond.
It was sort of a symbolic sort of show there, but look, we move forward. I have to lead.
Plus, how lawmakers are tackling the issues that unite, like rising anti-Semitism on college campuses and beyond.
These policies are not just good for Republicans, they're good for the whole country. And I think there are people of good faith on the other side of the aisle who understand that. I mean, particularly with regard to this issue of rising anti-Semitism. I mean, this is something that unites.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Stand by, Joe. 3, 2, 1, his mic, cue.
You're watching Squawk Box on CNBC. I'm Joe Kernan, along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. In a 359-43 vote, the House shot down efforts by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson. And Speaker Johnson joins us now. We are, I don't know why we just... We're thrilled to have you on. Whenever you come on, we get intoxicated by power, Speaker Johnson. That might be it. If we can't have the president or the vice president, then majority leader or speaker is next in line. Welcome. Thank you. It's good to have you on. Power is so fleeting, though, isn't it? You're in there again. I don't know. This is what you said I appreciate the show of confidence from my colleagues to defeat this misguided effort. Hopefully, it's the end of the personality politics, frivolous character assassination that has defined the 118th Congress. It's regrettable. It's not who we are as Americans. We need to get beyond it. It could happen again at the drop of a hat, right? Is that still possible that it can happen at any time? Do you think this makes that less likely?
Well, I think it does. It was an overwhelming vote, and I think what everyone here, frankly, on both sides of the aisle, were trying to demonstrate is that we live in very serious times. This is a dangerous time in history, world history, and certainly here on our own shores, and we cannot afford to be playing petty politics here. This country needs a functioning Congress, and if you remove a Speaker of the House closes down. I mean, it's a constitutional office, and so you cannot open the doors of the House. I mean, it literally is not operable, and we cannot afford to do that right now. We have hot wars around the globe. We've got massive challenges on our hands, and so everyone here, I think on both sides of the aisles, recognizes that we've just got to move forward and do our job, and that's what I do every day. I'm doing my job. I do what I know to be the right thing, and what I'm trying to do particularly is advance our conservative policies and principles, which I believe to be right for the country, as far as I can every day up the field, in spite of the fact that everyone knows we have the smallest majority in U.S. history. I'm at a one-vote margin right now, so
right.
not a lot of room for error, but we'll keep moving ahead.
And I guess it only took, it wouldn't have taken, I mean, you had 10. If, I mean, that was worse than Speaker McCarthy. I mean, he could only lose a couple of that. The crazy eight is what was there. So there are actually more maybe that were ready to throw you under the bus. But the Democrats in this case were decided that it's better to have you there than to go back into what we would be facing if that happened. But it does seem like for you to prevent it from happening, you need to play ball with them. And I think that's what some conservatives would say, that you're not in a position to buck what the Democrats want.
Well, let me say this. The handful of people, the 10 people, the Republicans that joined Marjorie Taylor Greene in voting against the motion to table, I don't think would have gone the next step and voted to vacate the chair. Okay. Several of them told me that. So it was sort of a symbolic sort of show there. But look, we move forward. I have to lead.
Right.
Newt Gingrich posted an op-ed last week and said, Johnson has the most challenging speakership since the Civil War over 150 years ago.
Yep.
Maybe it's true because there's a lot of interesting factors going on here, but we are undeterred in our challenge. What we have to do is fight for the things that we know to be right, to fix the country. We have the greatest collection of challenges right now, arguably, than we've had collectively maybe since World War II, maybe the Civil War. But we've got to get through this. And so this is the modern Congress. This is the age of social media. Everybody has their own media platform. They can go online every 2 minutes and say what they're disgruntled about. But we have to manage that and go forward, and that's what I do here every day.
I think Speaker McCarthy was doing what he thought was right, too, and we saw what happened there. You, on the other hand, were doing what you thought was right, and that's what you always got to do, and it worked out for you. Do you see any irony that what you did for Israel and maybe bringing on the wrath of some of your colleagues after going through all that? And now President Biden, to win Michigan, is not sending the weapons that country needs to do what it needs to do. You see any irony in that?
I do see irony in it, but greater than that, I see great danger. I mean, what the president is doing here is not only defying the will of Congress, to your point, we just voted on this several days ago, but he's also trying to dictate, I guess, and micromanage the war, the defense effort in Israel, as a condition of supplying the weapons that we all know that they desperately need. I spoke with Prime Minister Netanyahu myself less than 48 hours ago about this situation because I wanted to hear it directly from him. And what they're withholding is precision weapons that are desperately needed. Here's another irony. The precision weapons are needed to try to protect civilian lives in Rafah. These are the things that they need to do the job that must be done to eradicate the threat of Hamas, who is still lurking there. And so for Joe Biden to do this, he is going against what he told Congress, what his top officials in the White House specifically told me that they would do. And it's just catastrophic policy.
Speaker, do you think that President Biden's position is a moral one, meaning that he doesn't want to provide these munitions because he's worried about civilian casualties and believes morally that he doesn't want that to happen and thinks that he can somehow prevent it? Or do you think fundamentally it's a political calculus? Joe mentioned Michigan.
I believe it's 100% a political calculation. I think we can all see that. It's the same reason that he's making the political calculation not to call out anti-Semitism on the campuses, not to call out and bespeak without equivocation about the good versus evil here, the right versus the wrong. I mean, he has the largest bully pulpit in America. He's the commander-in-chief. He's the top elected official in our country. We desperately need him to look right into the camera and say, to speak with moral clarity, to say what is right and what is wrong. And he is unable and unwilling to do that because he doesn't want to offend a big segment of his base now, his party. There's an actual pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian wing.
I was going to say he was late. But Speaker, he did condemn anti-Semitism very recently in that Holocaust remembrance speech.
It was too little too late. I was sitting right, 10 feet away from him at Holocaust Memorial, and someone wrote that for him, and I'm glad he delivered it as he did. The speech that I gave a few minutes before he arrived actually at the event, was much more clear and much more direct. And look, he needs to do that consistently. He needs to do it every day. This is a problem that is growing across the country. It is not being diminished. And we're looking for moral leadership. The country needs moral leadership from both parties and from the top leaders. And he is the top leader in the country. I think he needs to act like it.
Mr. Speaker, could a bill pass to defund some of these colleges? I don't think that could pass. Given the support that the protesters have in certain parts of Congress.
Well, we're going to find that out because, as you know, last week, a week and a half ago, we launched a whole of Congress effort. We have six committees of jurisdiction, everything from the Ways and Means to the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, that are looking at every angle of that. We are deeply concerned about this idea that the Ivy Leagues and these other universities receive billions of dollars of taxpayer funds every year. This is the precious treasure of American taxpayers. They don't deserve it if they can't uphold the basic constitutional rights and the security and safety of their students. And some of them are unwilling to do that. They have demonstrated that. They are kowtowing to the violent protests, and they are ignoring the rights and the civil rights of their students who pay tuition and deserve and have the freedom and the right to go to class unimpeded and unafraid. And so that's the problem. So Congress is looking at that. We're looking at the funding streams. We're looking at the generous tax benefits that their endowments enjoy at these big universities, and also these foreign student visas. If you come over here and you're an aspiring terrorist, you don't deserve to be on an American campus. You don't deserve to be there threatening your Jewish classmates and peers just because of who they are. And we've got to get down to the bottom of that. I think there's a big appetite on both sides of the aisle here to address that. And I think that's something the American people will stand and applaud.
Speaker Johnson, I listened to President Biden after you all passed the aid to Ukraine and Israel. And in his speech about it, he gave you quite a bit of credit for being able to get this through and work together. He did slide into some election sort of tough talk at the same time, but it made me wonder if there is a new willingness or ability for the two sides to work together to get some things done, or if we're just too deep into an election year and that's not going to happen. Are there areas where you think you can work together? You just mentioned that there's appetite on both sides of the aisle for this bill to defund some of the Ivy Leagues. Is there that same sort of feeling on other major issues too?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, we're trying to advance what we believe to be the right thing, common sense policy. It's conservative. That's my brand. I'm a conservative on the right, a lifelong movement conservative. But these policies are not just good for Republicans. They're good for the whole country. And I think there are people of good faith on the other side of the aisle who understand that. I mean, particularly with regard to this issue of rising anti-Semitism. I mean, this is something that unites a lot of the people in the Congress on both sides of the aisle. And that's an important thing. And we need to address it together. You know, I went to Columbia University and spoke to that wild mob there a couple weeks back. And I had a couple of Democrat colleagues who had been there the day before who did the same thing. We applauded that. That's real courage, and that's moral clarity, and that's the kind that we need across the board, regardless of whether someone has an R or a D behind their name right now. That's what the country needs.
Mr. Speaker, I know you got to run, but I just want to ask you one more question about the SAVE Act, and it's Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, so that it would ensure that only U.S. citizens are able to vote in federal elections. It would require a proof of citizenship to register. I mean, it sounds like, wait, we don't do that now, but I guess we don't. But Is there any chance that sees the light of day? And do you think in this next election there will be many, many, many non-U.S. citizens able to vote?
I certainly know and believe and understand that that is the design, I think, of why they opened the border. I mean, this sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's the only theory that makes sense, that they, Joe Biden and Mayorkas, engineered the wide open border. They've allowed, by our count, my estimate is about 16 million illegals since Joe Biden walked into the Oval Office 3.5 years ago. And they did this because they ultimately, some in that party and some who engineered this, wanted to turn them into voters, and they wanted to affect the outcome of the next census by spreading them around the country. We're going to work on both of those issues, but that first one is, you're right, it is a violation of federal law right now. It's against statutory law for an illegal to vote in an election, in a federal election. But there's no way for the states to ask someone, if they check the box and say, I'm a citizen, when they do the motor voter registration, if that's actually true. There's no mechanism to prove it, believe it or not. And so we're going to fix that. We're bringing a bill, the SAVE Act, that will solve that problem. I think it's common sense.
But the Democrats won't. I don't know what they'd come up with something, but that won't pass, will it?
It will be stunning if they vote against that. Some will, but they'll have to explain why they're in opposing existing federal law and why they want illegals to vote in U.S. elections.
Just said
good luck
why.
With that one.
They got a very good reason.
Right,
why?
But they can't say the quiet part out loud. We're about to find out. 76% of the American people understand that's a priority, and by some polls, 86% of the American people want only U.S. citizens to vote in U.S. elections. What a concept, right? We're trying to advance common sense here. We certainly hope that everybody gets on board with that.
All right, Mr. Speaker, thanks once again for coming in Squawk Box this morning.
Still to come on Squawk Pod, journalist Johan Hari is on Ozempic.
The second day I took it, I woke up and I was lying in bed and I thought, I feel something really strange. What am I feeling? I couldn't locate in my body what it was. And then I realized I had woken up and I wasn't hungry.
He says it changed and probably saved his life. But the drugs have enormous risks. His new book, Magic Pill, explores the social weight of obesity treatments and why regulating access is so critical.
My biggest worry, not for me, but for many people, eating disorders.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Andrew.
An obesity treatment getting more popular. We talk about it all the time. A new op-ed in the New York Times tackles the legacy of judgment and morality in weight loss. The piece is titled A Year on Ozempic Taught Me We're Thinking About Obesity All Wrong. And its author joins us now, our journalist Johan Hari. He's got a new book out. It's called Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drug. So here we have you here to tell us. We all debate it. We're not on it, so we don't know.
No.
Tell us about this experience. What is your relationship with food like? And what is the biggest lesson of all of this for you?
It's the strangest thing when you start taking these drugs. Obviously, I spent a year doing a really deep dive into the science all over the world, interviewing the leading experts on this to see how it's going to affect us and our economy and our society. But when you actually take it, I thought it'd be silly to write the book and not take it, and I was very overweight at the time. It's the weirdest feeling. I'll never forget, the second day I took it, I woke up, and I was lying in bed, and I thought, I feel something really strange. What am I feeling? I couldn't locate in my body what it was. And then I realized I had woken up and I wasn't hungry. That had never happened to me before, right? And I went to a diner just up the street from where I live and I ordered what I used to order every morning, which was a huge brown chicken roll with loads of mayo in it and loads of chicken. And I had like 3 mouthfuls and I couldn't eat anymore. So what these drugs do, there are extraordinary benefits and disturbing risks to these drugs, but what they do is they give you a feeling of satiety that has been stolen from us by the kind of food I've been eating all my life, junk food.
Can I ask you a question though about this?
Sure.
Your relationship with food,
Do you still enjoy the food? Do you feel that it has changed your level of happiness around food?
So
in a good way, in a bad way? Because that's something we've all talked about, just
I love
living
diners.
Life.
I don't want to go to a diner.
Right. No, you're right. This is I go through really big drawbacks to these drugs in the book. There are 12 big risks associated with them, some of which I'm very worried about, along with these incredible benefits. Lots of people just lose their pleasure in food. I actually had the opposite experience. I realized how much I ate to calm myself down and stuff myself, right? From when I was a small child, that a lot of people have that relationship with food. And you literally can't do that when you take these drugs, right? If you tried to kind of go to KFC and pig out, you would throw up. Right. So actually for me, because it slowed down my eating, I actually take more pleasure in food now, but I'm unusual. Most people are more like, your concern is absolutely legitimate.
You know, I've wondered if it would ruin what you feel, the pleasure you take in other things too. And the only thing I can liken it to, and I don't know if this is true, like probably once every year, every 2 years, I'll get pretty sick and I won't eat anything for 5 to 7 days because I just can't. You lose weight. I don't want to eat anything. Mm. When I feel better, I go back to eating and I go back to my normal size. Is it like that? Does it take the joy out of other things or you haven't noticed any?
So a significant minority of people who take these drugs seem to be becoming depressed. There's even some concern about possible suicidal ideation. It's a huge debate about why that might be. We know these drugs primarily work on your brain, not on your gut. There's been a shift in the science, interview the leading neuroscientists about this. So there's a concern that it may be dampening the reward systems in your brain in exactly the way you're worried about, although other scientists strongly contest that. But it's really interesting. When you look at the risks of the drugs like that, you'd think, well, it'd be crazy to take this. But what we have to do is weigh two very specific things. You have to weigh the risks of the drugs, which are real and significant, all the concerns you're raising are really important, against the risks of continuing to be obese. Realistically, I would have continued to be obese, right? This is the biggest killer
in
this country.
Everything bad.
It is.
Everything bad.
I have to say, I was and I'm embarrassed to say this because it will sound naive. I was stunned when I looked at the evidence of how bad for you obesity is. It causes 200 known diseases and complications. You're much more likely to get cancer, dementia, stroke,
everything.
I mean, just across the board. So the really extraordinary benefit of this drug, this range of drugs, you lose 15 to 24% of your body weight. Mm-hmm. If you reverse your obesity, you dramatically improve your health. I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be because he died of a heart attack when he was 44. This is quite possibly
so
saving my life.
The holy grail, and you're right, microdosing with a pill.
And if you look at that, you're totally
is that
right.
possible?
So there's a big debate about this, and there are now experiments going on with it. But if you look at Barclays Bank commissioned a very sober-minded financial analyst called Emily Field to look into these drugs to figure guide their investment decisions going forward.
Not related to Mrs. Fields. See, I'm always thinking about food. I am. I'm always thinking about food.
But like, she came back and said, if you want a comparison for the effect this will have on the economy, you've got to look at the invention of the smartphone, right? 47% of Americans want to take this drug. This is the biggest, obesity is the biggest killer in the society. These drugs are going to be enormous.
Tell me, though, what it's done to you in terms of exercise. So the other issue is that people who do take these drugs, in some ways, some people exercise more because they actually now, they're not obese, so it's actually easier to exercise. But a lot of people don't because they say, look, I'm really thin now. I don't need to exercise.
Yeah.
And then there's a big issue about, we were talking about muscles, you know, even muscles in your face. You talk about a Ozempic face. And my understanding is part of that is related that people don't eat enough. Because they're not eating enough to begin with, you almost have to force feed yourself protein to actually keep any muscle strength.
Yeah, it's a really important point. So there's lots of things in what you just said, but if you think about one just in terms of muscle, so one of the big worries about these drugs is as you age, you naturally lose muscle mass, which is the soft tissue in your body you need to move, climb the stairs, get out of a chair or whatever. And actually, depressingly, you start to lose it at the age of 30, which I think is a very depressing thought for me. What these drugs do, like any other form of weight loss, is they really reduce your amount of muscle mass. So the danger is you're going into the aging process, which
with less muscle mass.
And this is particularly an issue. So I would say it's
You believe it's so there's a debate about this, whether it's the drugs that's reducing the muscle mass itself.
No.
Or the fact that people who are taking these drugs are no longer moving or exercising the same way and or this protein issue.
Oh, no, we know all forms of weight loss cause a loss. You lose weight, so you lose both fat mass and muscle mass. Almost everyone does. This is particularly risky, that risk of the 12 risks that I talk about in my book, Magic Pill. That one's particularly salient for people who are already thin, who are taking them to be super thin, right? Because they're going to have, and we've got to really distinguish a few different groups. There's people who are overweight and obese, who are taking them to come down to a healthy weight. They're still incurring lots of risks about thyroid cancer, risks about pregnancy. Right. But I think there's a really strong case for that when you weigh the balance of risk, particularly if you started as severely obese. For people who are already thin, I would say you're incurring a lot of the risks, but only an aesthetic benefit.
Eli Lilly is working on a pill version of this, but it doesn't work on both.
Right,
the gut hormones. Yeah. Yeah,
right. Both hormones. It only works on one hormone. Right. Do you think that just working on one hormone is going to be enough? Is that going to be the microdosed version? Because, for example, because it's not as extreme, is that going to be? How do you think about that?
So, as one of the leading scientists put it to me, we've cracked the code of what causes weight loss: gut hormones. And there are more than 70 gut hormones that affect weight loss and appetite. Right. So now that we know, tinkering with that is what changes, is what can lead to weight loss. There's going to be an extraordinary range of development of these drugs. Some will be microdosing smaller ones, some will be bigger doses. We're going to discover more. But as one leading scientist put it to me, we've found the holy grail. We've cracked the code.
I know we got to go downside, though. Do you feel like there's a downside to all of this?
Oh, there's a huge downside. I'm really worried about lots of risks. My biggest worry, not for me, but for many people, eating disorders. There are loads of young girls who, and unfortunately, as girls,
God,
trying to starve themselves. The worst case scenario is we could have an opioid-like scale of death of young girls who are able to amputate their appetite using these drugs in a way they wouldn't be. That's why we urgently need to regulate. You should only be able to get these drugs from an in-person, inpatient appointment with a doctor who is trained in detecting eating disorders. There's incredible benefits to these drugs. They're probably saving my life. There are incredible risks. We really need to take a beat and think deeply
about
it.
Johan, the book
this.
Is called Magic Pill. This is an awesome conversation. I'll come on
pleasure.
Back and we'll discuss it more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That does it for Squawk Pod today. One more day closer to the weekend. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. You can tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern to catch them live. And you can listen anytime when you follow this podcast. Squawk Pod brings the best of our morning show right into your ears. And you can check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.